Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Eight Little Piggies, Reflections in Natural History by Stephen Jay Gould, narrated by Jonathan Sleep. A Reflective Prologue. These essays, Volume 6 in a continuing series, confront history on the broadest scale of life's evolution during 3.5 billion years. Since macrocosms are fractals of microcosms, the series also records a personal history. In the sweetest introduction I have ever received for a talk at the Academy of Natural Sciences in San Francisco, former Major League ballplayer and current eco-activist Bruce Bochy recounted my article on why Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak is the greatest accomplishment in the history of baseball. He then pointed out that I was working on a 208 monthly essay streak, also unbroken since its inception in January 1974. Over such a long stretch of adulthood, ranging from relative youth in my early 30s to distinct middle age, just past the half-century mark, many passages must be noted as the ineluctable changes of life unfold. Two aspects of ontogeny seem especially relevant to this continuing series. First, Eight Little Piggies is a book of middle life, and it does contrast entirely favorably, I think, but I'm no longer talking to my 30-something self, with my youthful ever-since Darwin. I suppose that the major sign of this particular passage lies in my exploration of a traditional essay genre that I had previously shunned, the contemplative and highly personal ruminations in Section 4, Musings. These essays on memory, persistence, and authenticity talk about the importance of unbroken connections within our own lives and to our ancestral generations, a theme of supreme importance to evolutionists who study a world in which extinction is the ultimate fate of all and prolonged persistence the only meaningful measure of success. These essays may treat familiar themes, but at least they follow my idiosyncratic procedure of building, via oddly tangential connections, from a small and concrete item or incident to a broad generality. From sitting with my grandfather on some warehouse steps to characteristic pathways of false memory in our favorite stories, Essay 11. From a graveyard and the invisibility of a large factory in Amana, Iowa, to our need for bucolic myths and the false concept of past golden ages, Essay 12. From calling cards and a visit with a 97-year-old paleontologist who knew C.D. Walcott to the importance we place on continuity and non-vicarious experience, Essay 13. And from a breakfast in San Francisco to a taxonomy of authenticity and the role of vernacular customs and architectures in the preservation of regional diversity, Essay 14. All these essays feature our treatment and distortion of historical records, a kind of ultimate subject for any paleontologist. Second, the six volumes form a sensible series, each with a different central focus appropriate to its time in three ways: stage in my own life, reaction to current events, and position in the developing logic of an extended discourse on evolution and history. The first volume, Ever Since Darwin, 1977, centers upon the basic explication of Darwinian principles. Where else would one start? The Panda's Thumb, 1980, develops the largely unrecognized extensions and corrections of Darwinism that run so counter to many sociocultural hopes and expectations, as in the principle of imperfection embodied in the title example. Hen's Teeth and Horse's Toes, 1983, had an immediate focus that now, and happily, seems a bit outdated, but by no means dead. The attack of creation science, biblical literalism, upon teaching evolution, and our victories both in courtrooms and in cogent and decent argument. The Flamingo's Smile, 1985, emphasizes the importance of randomness and unpredictability in the history of life. This theme had a double and immediate origin at two levels: my own bout with cancer at the most personal, and the proposal and successful development of the asteroidal impact theory of mass extinction at the broadest and most general. Bully for Brontosaurus, 1991, following a longer gap for rumination and synthesis, then put the two central themes together, the mechanics of Darwinism with the unpredictability of complex temporal sequences, to form, finally, a full-scale disquisition on the nature of history and its primary theme of contingency, also explored in my intervening Wonderful Life, 1989. I like to think of these volumes as building rather than replacing. The old foci carry over and weave together, tightening up thereby and leaving room for new extensions. Yet one theme of transcendent and growing importance has been almost absent, and shamefully so, from my writings heretofore. How can any naturalist, any self-professed lover of diversity, ignore the subject of anthropogenic environmental deterioration and massive extinction of species on our present Earth? Oh, I have not entirely bypassed this central concern of my profession. Side comments and paragraphs abound, and even a full essay or two, Essay 29 on Nuclear Winter and the Flamingo Smile, for example. But I've never addressed this theme centrally and head-on. My reluctance reflects no failure of strong feelings, quite the contrary. If anything, I've desisted because my feelings are too powerful, lying in the domain that Wordsworth described as thoughts that do often lie too deep for tears, and perhaps for words as well. I've never found any distinctive words to convey these common emotions. I could not bear merely to write the shibboleths of the movement, or even worse, to emote for show, catharsis, or accountability, but with nothing different to add to the hyperabundance of current expostulations. Perhaps I've finally found something to say that might be helpful rather than only repetitive. Eight Little Piggies includes a section placed primus inter pares on the sadness of anthropogenic destruction. But if I have finally found a voice, I came to it in my usual way, entirely unanticipated and via a quirky item arising from a personal experience then adumbrated along a forest of tangents. I went to French Polynesia with my son in the summer of 1991 and learned that the island of Moorea had served as the model for Rodgers and Hammerstein's Bali High of South Pacific. I also knew that Moorea and other adjacent islands had recently experienced a tragically unnecessary extinction of a large, beautiful, and historically important fauna of land snails, the genus Partula, that had been the life's work of Henry Crampton, a great scholar of land snails who was revered within the profession, if unknown outside. My technical research is on land snails, so this is my community. Finally, I had a place to stand. By focusing on the cruel and ironic erasure of Crampton's lifelong struggle, rather than only on the animals, I could construct a humanistic reversal for the usual focus on animal victims, primary and perfectly appropriate, of course, but so often said by people with a far better sense of the necessary poetry. The Bali High setting was irresistible, especially with the titular pun of unenchanted evening. So I rented South Pacific, bless the VCR, as a new research tool, and wove a nexus of humanistic references into a piece that tries to construct a reversed, people-centered perspective on the tragedy of extinction. But I could also use the emotionalism of Ezio Pinza and his great song to end with a re-reversal and acknowledge, as must be done, the primal and primary rights of nature and her beauty. The package worked, at least for some people, of two close colleagues who had studied Partula before its extinction on Moorea. The American wrote to tell me that he'd been moved to tears, while the Englishman, from the world of stiff upper lips, wrote to inform me that his wife had cried. I then round out this first section of essays with a most general perspective, though arising from a few squirrels, based on the geologist's primary theme of timescales and their limited domains of application, Essay 2, followed by a small story about the first death of a marine invertebrate species in our times, just a tale on one level, but also a powerful symbol of impending trouble, Essay 3. If these two sections on musings and extinctions represent additions based on changing times and personal growth, aging might be a more honest description, The other six sections follow the traditions of previous volumes and tell new stories about new themes, mixed with some golden oldies in the domains of evolutionary theory and the history of life. Section 2, Odd Bits of Vertebrate Anatomy, takes four central principles for explaining evolutionary legacies and transitions and illustrates them with intriguing peculiarities of restricted parts in vertebrate anatomy. The fact that earliest land vertebrates had up to 8 digits per limb, and that 5 is therefore not canonical, the eponym for this entire volume. The tailbend of ichthyosaurs, the evolution of mammalian ear bones from reptilian jawbones, and why the evolution of swim bladders from lungs, and not vice versa, as Darwin assumed, and as many texts still proclaim, is neither paradoxical nor contrary to our usual view of evolutionary sequences in vertebrates. Vox Populi, title of the next section, is a double entendre. My essays on the central works of individual scientists have always been my personal favorites. They are, literally, Vox Populi, as essays about individual scientists. But the title also recalls a trenchant line from Darwin, where he argues that the old motto of Vox Populi, Vox Dei, the voice of the people is the voice of God, cannot apply to science. This is not a plea for elitism, but a recognition that traditional ways of thought often block understanding. All my essays on individuals try to rescue interesting and honorable, not necessarily correct, effort from the opposite dangers of historical legacy. Scorn for enemies and hagiography for heroes, opposite in content perhaps, but eerily similar in debarring our sympathetic understanding. Section 5, Human Nature, treats the subject that, at least in a legitimately parochial sense, is the most pressing and important to the interface of evolutionary biology and human life. How to avoid the pitfalls of biological determinism and its unfortunate legacy in social use, and the simple silliness of sociobiology when done in the strictly adaptionist and speculative mode, still the canonical form in pop culture and not at all rare in professional literature, and to discover what our biological heritage and the principles of evolutionary change truly have to tell us about the nature of our mentality and behavior. The next two sections treat the main body of evolutionary theory, but in a personal and iconoclastic spirit. Section 6 on broad patterns in time, and Section 7 on basic Darwinian theory and some important revisions. Section 6 is divided into two parts. The first, Essays 21 and 22, stand together as a duet and try to present a coherent case for the central role of sensible unpredictability as the major feature of life's history. Essay 21 sets out the necessary and sufficient major condition, and Essay 22 forges a double whammy by adding an equally powerful theme that makes the result even worse for those committed to conventions of progress and predictability, but ever so much more fascinating for those who wish to grasp the richness of sensible history. The second pair of essays continues the wonderful and rapidly developing story of surprises in documenting the vast anatomical explosion that heralded the first flowering of multicellular life. The essays of Section 7, Revising and Extending Darwin, may be the most challenging in the book, but this subject, too often ignored in popular presentations, cannot be bypassed by anyone who wishes to grasp the depth of evolutionary theory. The low road, too often taken, merely speaks of the power of natural selection and leaves listeners with the cardboard view that evolution may be equated with the building of nicely working organic machinery. This section treats principles additional to, and in important ways restrictive of, natural selection, internal constraints, and historical legacies, Essays 25 through 27, and randomness as a force for change, not merely as a source of raw material for natural selection, Essay 28. Evolution is much more than a story of matching form to local environments, with increments of general progress slowly accumulating through time, the usual view of pure Darwinian functionalism. Any genealogy is a complex tale of interplay between these Darwinian themes and a set of forces based on the internal genetic and developmental architecture of organisms that produce different historical patterns and conceptual meanings. The material may be more difficult, but I've tried to approach this vital subject by concrete example. The coloration of pigeons, fishtails, and frog calls, different ranges of morphological variety in domesticated dogs and cats, and the eye tissue of completely blind mole rats. Perspectives that are reversed or orthogonal to traditional modes form my stock in trade. I have long argued that conceptual locks are far more powerful than factual lacks as barriers to scientific understanding. About 20 years ago, I got an idea for such a reversed book on the history of evolutionary thought. I would describe this science via the organisms studied rather than the folks so engaged. Instead of chapters on Lamarck, Cuvier, Darwin, and Mendel, I would write about trilobites, ammonites, and Tyrannosaurus. For a variety of reasons, I never pursued the project to full fruition, but I still like the idea, and putative chapters can stand as full essays. The last section, Section 8 on Reversals, offers two such chapters. Essays 29 and 30 are a miniature Rashomon, two different perspectives, one based on specimens, the other on iconography, on three major worldviews applied sequentially to the study of Cephalaspis, most famous of the earliest vertebrates. I generally try to expunge redundancy when I gather these several years of monthly essays into a single collection, though I have allowed two pieces to finish with the same wonderful last lines of Darwin's Origin of Species. But in the duet of essays 29 and 30, the redundancy is studied and intentional, for a pair of such different looks at the same story carries its own power, just as the great Japanese film taught us. The last essay, A Foot Soldier for Evolution, tells the story of a clam studied by nearly every important evolutionist from Lamarck on. The title is a double entendre, as organisms are the rank and file of this grand history. My main reason for planning such a book, for history by organisms must be more democratic than chapters on people, where we are driven to rank from Darwin down. And clams, in particular, are Pelecypoda, in technical parlance, meaning hatchetfoot, and therefore truly foot soldiers. The epilogue to this essay provides, at my expense, the most important of all lessons in science, and a fitting end to the book. All these essays first appeared as columns in my monthly series, This View of Life, in Natural History Magazine. I regard this volume as a true natural selection, since many have been dumped and the others improved and then organized into a sensible and coherent sequence, more organic than linear in its webs of cross-referencing. The many that I now dislike or regard as substandard are on the scrap heap, so I will stand by all items in the present winnowing and reshaping. But some, inevitably, please me more than others, or at least serve as better exemplars of my chosen style. I think that I am condemned to like best the essays that are most difficult or most focused on particulars of little public knowledge or approbation. I am not hopelessly rarefied or ethereal, and I do feel quite warmly towards some of the most evident, if vital, themes and homely illustrations, as in Musings on Distortions of Memory and Myths of Past Golden Ages, essays 13 and 14. But I do so wish that some of the more complex pieces could receive some share of attention. I especially like Essay 29 because focusing on specimens rather than scientists so well highlights the crucial duality of all scientific activity, tension between the necessary social embeddedness of all scientific thinking and progress towards more adequate factual knowledge of an external reality, by pathways often tortuous and circuitous. If everyone knew the beauty and oddness of actual Cephalaspis fossils, this essay would be a sure winner, but knowledge is a prerequisite for this kind of love. For this reason, we need more hands-on science education, and we must resist the terrible current trend to confuse museums with theme parks, wonderful things in their proper domain, and to replace real specimens with large, throbbing, blinking glitz in order, ultimately, to pack more bodies into the gift shop. Also, please study Essay 25, even if you revile pigeons. C.O. Whitman was one of our greatest biologists, and the key theme of his pigeon work really does speak to the nature of mind as a product of evolution. I adore all the odd animals and anatomical bits that I pack into these essays, but I've always liked my people pieces best. My favorite essays in the last three volumes are the titular bishop of Titiopolis on Nicholas Steno in Hen's Teeth and Horse's Toes, Adam's Navel on Gauss's bizarrely magnificent treatise Omphalos in The Flamingo Smile, and In a Jumbled Drawer on the conventional career of N.S. Shaler and the iconoclasm of William James in Bully for Brontosaurus. People ask how I keep finding honorable intent in reviled characters by the simple expedient of rediscovering either the full logic of their argument or the social context of their claims. Are all thinkers so worthy of respectful resurrection? Of course not. Many are reviled in their own time for good reasons that remain equally cogent today. For the most part, I don't choose to write about these people. I praise Archbishop Usher, Essay 12, so falsely labeled as a unique reactionary shoving his finger into the crumbling dike of revealed religion in order to hold back the flood of science, when he actually represented a large research tradition, humanistically motivated and successful in its own terms, though wrong about the age of the earth due to a false premise at the core of the argument. I warm to a paranoid dyspeptic like Eugene Dubois, Essay 8, when he fairly sticks to his guns in a noble, if losing argument, but when posterity, not even trying to grasp the subtlety, invariably reports that he finally labeled his precious ape man a giant gibbon, although he actually, by this trope of argument, and when you grasp his full system rather than picking at isolated straws, tried to affirm the immediately ancestral status of his Homo erectus. But the saints often need intellectual resurrection as well, though I'd rather be misunderstood in clouds of celestial music than bubbles of boiling magma. Halley is so tied to his eponymous comet that his work on the Earth's age is largely ignored and usually interpreted ass-backwards when mentioned at all, Essay 11. Goethe's oracular reduction of all plant form to a leaf archetype needs to be read for its unconventional form of scientific excellence, Essay 10. I also like to find unusual entrees to important subjects generally treated under conventional formats. Thus, I approach Darwin's personal views on race and sex, not by analyzing the Descent of Man, though I do not ignore this primary document, but by studying his very first publication, an article with Captain Fitzroy on the Moral State of Tahiti, Essay 18. As for the hottest topic of modularity in cognitive science, I never found a distinctive way until I learned that an English dilettante named Daines Barrington had published an article in England's leading scientific journal on Mozart's musical abilities as a child of 8. Barrington wrote when young Wolfgang represented a generic prodigy and had not yet become, so to speak, Mozart. Thus, he could be presented as a type, a general puzzle in why musical ability could be so hypertrophied in an otherwise ordinary boy. All this, in the propitious time of Mozart's bicentennial year, led me to Darwin on Mind, Tinbergen on the Evolution of Behavior and Cognition in General, my own puzzling over Michelangelo's stunning effect in using modularity to carve his statue of Moses, even via Monty Python and back to Mr. Barrington on the literary convention and odd name of Lytetes to mask wonderment, thus giving me a string to tie my beginning to a stylistically gentle end. Not bad. I often wonder what I'm doing every month. I can't be just a dilettante or poseur, or the streak wouldn't be continuing with such undiminished commitment and ardor, such love of each little new thing learned. I guess I see myself in the guise of Papageno, the birdcatcher of Mozart's magic flute. He captures but does not harm the most beautiful objects of nature. He is capable of naive wonder, counting as originality and breaking through conventional prejudice, as when frightened by the more monostatos, he stops and upbraids himself, "How foolish! Blackbirds exist, so why not black men?" He wins at the end the greatest Darwinian prize of continuity, as he finally gets his Papagena and the promise of many little Papaginos and Papaginas to follow. I think of them as essays, but do not doubt his overwhelming modesty amidst all the showy confidence. I sense how rich and complex it is out there, and what a tiny, tiny part any of us has been able to understand. and I feel much like Papageno as he struggles to sing but can produce no words, though he hums a lovely melody, because his mouth is padlocked. Nonetheless, if I could have but one Mozartian wish, although it will be as unrealistic as the original claim itself, and although this series will stop Deo Volenti in January 2001, I would request the time to write as many monthly essays as the Don had women in Spain. Ma in España. 1. The Scale of Extinction. 1. Unenchanted Evening. Tahiti is the stereotype, virtually the synonym, of enchantment in our legends. Nurse Forbush from Little Rock might have been a charmer, especially when played by Mary Martin, but the South Sea locale made a strong contribution to Some Enchanted Evening, and Ezio Pinza, the greatest of operatic Don Giovanni's slumming on Broadway, didn't hurt the scene either. Some aspects of the legend need correction. Point Venus, for example, still the landing spot for many tourists, is not named for the beauty of Tahiti's women, but for astronomy and Captain Cook, who set up his instruments at the site to measure the transit of the planet Venus across the disk of the sun in 1769. Charles Darwin himself was beguiled both by the name and the place when he arrived on the Beagle in November 1835. We landed to enjoy all the delights of the first impressions produced by a new country, and that country the charming Tahiti. A crowd of men, women, and children was collected on the memorable Point Venus, ready to receive us with laughing, merry faces. Darwin, however, broke ranks with male convention in expressing a lack of enthusiasm for Tahiti's women. I was much disappointed in the personal appearance of the women. They are far inferior in every respect to the men. He objected most of all to the current fad in coiffure. An unbecoming fashion in one respect is now almost universal. It is the cutting of hair, or rather shaving it, from the upper part of the head in a circular form so as to leave only an outer ring of hair. The missionaries have tried to persuade the people to change this habit, but it is the fashion, and that is sufficient answer at Tahiti as well as at Paris. Darwin's heterodox judgment had not been widely shared. Captain Bligh, who got such a bum rap from Charles Lawton, may not win any medals for grasping human psychology, but he was a great seaman and no more dictatorial than the normal run of British shipmasters. The celebrated mutiny on his bounty owed as much to Fletcher Christian's longing for Tahiti and the women he left behind as to any of Bligh's shipboard policies. Tahiti may be beautiful, but the title for picture-perfect paradise has usually been awarded, and rightly so in my judgment, for I've just returned from my first visit to French Polynesia, to the neighboring island of Mo'orea. Located just 12 miles northwest of Tahiti, Mo'orea is an extinct volcano with a soaring crater rim deeply dissected by later erosion into jagged peaks and draperies. Seen from Tahiti, especially when enshrouded by its usual entourage of seemingly personal clouds, Mo'orea becomes a most fitting symbol of beauty combined with mystery. One day on Tahiti, Charles Darwin scaled a local peak and received his dose of Mo'orea's spell. From the point which I attained, there was a good view of the distant island of Aimeo, the old name for Mo'orea. On the lofty and broken pinnacles, white massive clouds were piled up, which formed an island in the blue sky, as Aimeo itself did in the blue ocean. This impression of beauty and mystery has certainly persisted. Oscar Hammerstein used Mo'orea as his model for Bali High, the off-limits paradise of delight in South Pacific. Bali High will whisper, on the wind of the sea, here I am, your special island, come to me, come to me. Who could resist these enticements, especially for a few francs and a 40-minute ferry ride? So my son Ethan and I visited Mo'orea on our recent trip. We were not disappointed. Unfortunately, the lure of Bali High has attracted other guests, some not so harmless. This essay is a story of genocide in paradise, a preventable wholesale slaughter just completed in one human generation. You do not know the tale only because it pitted snail against snail rather than man against man. but do not breathe a sigh of relief for moral exculpation of our species. Snails killed snails, but humans imported the agent of death, consciously and for decent motives, but with tragic and easily avoidable mis-
Sample complete. Ready to continue?